Indeed, this might sound like a bit of a familiar story because it plays out in both Luke's and Matthew's gospel. There's a little bit of a difference between the two, though. In Matthew's gospel, it's the centurion who goes and has an experience with Jesus, and there's that encounter between the two of them. In Luke's gospel, the centurion sends other folks. And at first glance, we might want to look at it and go, well, my golly, isn't he a pompous so-and-so? He wouldn't even go to see Jesus himself. Instead, he sends some elders, some Jewish elders, some folks with some standing in the community. It's one of those pieces when I think you first hear it, you kind of think of, well, wow, I didn't think if I went and asked for something that I would get a favorable response, so I recruited some folks that had some clout, right? They had some public cash, and they were going to go and impress upon Jesus what the centurion needed. You know, it's like when we say, I'm not sure if I'll get listened to, so I'm going to talk to my city councilor, and they'll listen to him or her. Or the same way with our MP, right? Like we want to get something done, so we're going to go talk to those who have some authority, some power in our society, and we'll get them to go and talk on our behalf. And somehow, by some strange twist of reality, just those folks showing up on our behalf somehow legitimizes the request. I mean, those folks are so busy, they wouldn't waste their time on something trivial. It must be serious that these elders have shown up. Not only that, they give credence to the request, not just in their presence, but in their words about why they came. And that's missing in Matthew's gospel. Likewise, a little later on, there's the friends of the centurion come and they stop Jesus from getting any closer to the house. And again, we'd go, well, what? You sent one delegation? Wasn't that enough? Somehow you had to kind of ratchet it up. Friends in Scripture quite often doesn't just refer to friends like you and I would talk about friends. It's not just kind of the folks you hang out with or the folks you text back and forth or send emails to or spend hours with on the phone or go to some kind of social event together. It's not friends like that. It's more akin to the elders, but this time they're not Jewish folks. They're probably Gentiles, but they're folks of some kind of social standing. It's as if the centurion is saying, look at whom I'm connected to. I bet you don't have these folks following you on Facebook. I can send a message to these folks, and they get it done. They make stuff happen, so pay attention. At least that's the temptation, I think, when we first read it. And then we discover that there might be something else going on in this text. There might be some other reason for Luke to include these details that seem to be missing in other retellings of this story. Richard Horsley reminds us that Roman occupiers terrorized people into submission through the ruthless devastation of the land and towns, the slaughter and enslavement of the people, and the crucifixion of people along the roadways or in public places. In theory, the centurion didn't have to ask. He could have simply demanded, I'm a centurion. I command about 80 folks. I have connections. I've already demonstrated that. I'm not asking you to do something for me, Jesus. I'm telling you. That would be the normal expression of a social contract in this kind of economy. I do this, you do that. I have power, you do not. What I say is law, your job is to follow it. That's the kind of society that's being depicted. And in many ways, it's the same social contract that extends down through time, down to us sitting here. I voted for you. Therefore, the social contract is that you will implement laws and policies that I find favorable. That's why I voted for you. or I support you, therefore you will do the things that I ask, or I'm your employer, or I pay you, or I donate, or whatever, and then there are expectations around how your labor is spent and divided. It's a very transactional social contract. There is an in and an out, a give and a take, and the two go back and forth. It's an unwritten expectation and understanding in our world. And in many ways, I think it's at the root of most of our challenges in our world. Because it doesn't see us as being in relationship with one another. It sees us as commodities to be exchanged back and forth. And so we have whole departments called human resources. And every time I hear it, it makes my skin crawl. I understand we have relationships together and rules around how those relationships are shaped. But to see human beings as nothing more than a resource, in my opinion, opens the door to see human beings as nothing more than something to be exploited. Because after all, that's what we do with resources around the world. We exploit them. Often for the benefit of the 1% to the detriment of the 99. And so that's how this story could have played out. That's certainly how it's set up at the very beginning. But then we hear maybe the centurion has a different kind of sensibility than we might have first thought. That it isn't because they're pompous and arrogant for not coming to see Jesus, but because they understand the dynamics of the culture in which they were living. And that to invite Jesus in would have been to invite them into a space that was impure. It would have been to force Jesus to be in a kind of conversation and in a place that would have caused trouble for Jesus. And so the centurion knows better. In many ways, the centurion embodies the opposite of the social contract. It's not someone who abuses their power, but rather acts in an ethical, admirable, even faithful way to administrate the authority that they've been given. The authority, in all reality, that they had taken. In other words, it's still possible to be a good person even in a corrupt system. It's not easy, but it's possible. A long time ago, I had the opportunity and the privilege to serve a congregation in Port Alberni, British Columbia. For those of you that don't know where Port Alberni is, if you stick your finger in the middle of Vancouver Island, you probably got it on Port Alberni. It is the gateway to the West Coast. People go through Port Alberni to get to Tofino and Ucluelet. Those tend to be the places everybody talks about. You then drive through Cathedral Grove and, right, you get to the beaches and all that kind of stuff. But Port Alberni is there. One of the things that makes Port Alberni important in Indigenous and Canadian history is that it was the site of the Port Alberni Indian Residential Institution. If you've never been to a site like that, that kind of memorial site, there's a couple of things I want to mention to you about it, and that is that it is one of the few places I've ever been that claimed to be a school where it was surrounded by a chain link fence. And if you understand how chain link fence works, if you have barbed wire at the top of it, typically you point the wire out. It's to prevent stuff from getting over the fence and coming in. That's the idea. At the Port Alberni Indian Residential Institution, the wire on the top was tilted inwards, more like you would see at a prison. It was meant to keep people in, not keep other things out. And there is still a section of fence like that that you must pass on your way in. It was a reminder for me of our participation in colonialism and what it means to be empire and what it means to abuse the authority that is invested or the authority that we take. I've often told the story of being at a funeral where it was the only time I think that I remember being ashamed of the Christian church. I was at a funeral for an Indian residential school survivor, held in the gymnasium that was reclaimed by the band of the Port Alberni Indian Residential School and Institution. Sometime afterwards, I got to have a conversation with one of the teachers that had been there, and they were wrestling with the legacy of what had happened at residential schools. And I remember them saying to me, "Bob, I'm careful who I tell I was a teacher there, because they automatically assume that I'm a horrible, evil, nasty person who did unspeakable things to kids and tried to impose a religion upon them and strip a culture away from them. And that's not who I am. That's not what I thought we were doing, and certainly not what they did." And I find this text and that story have this piece in common, that we sometimes need to check our biases and assumptions when we're entering into a space and into a conversation. Because while sometimes we're right, that's why our assumptions get validated, many times we're wrong. And we forget that it is possible to be a good person in a corrupt system. That it is possible to live our lives in a faith-based way, even when the world tells us that's not the way to get ahead. Margaret Lamont Torrance comments that in the end, the centurion trusts in the power and the healing love enfleshed in Jesus, and perhaps that is the key to our reclamation of the word authority. To assert Jesus' authority is not to suggest a coercive power, rather to trust that Jesus' authority is to affirm his intimate connection to the author, the originator of all life. Saying that our participation is in a different kind of economy with a different kind of social construct, one based on faith, based on following in Jesus, is the amazement in the story. That is what amazes Jesus. It isn't that the centurion came and asked him for a favor. That was happening all the time. It isn't even that he sent some other folks to ask on their behalf. I'm sure that was happening all the time. It's the reason behind and how the centurion asks. This assumption that Jesus had that kind of authority to change the world. And Jesus points out this centurion has more faith than anybody else I've experienced in all of Jerusalem, in all of Israel, in Galilee or Judea. This centurion gets it. He understands what it is the gospel is really all about. And it really is about our ability to have faith in a system that is countercultural to the reality that is enforced upon us, the one that we are encouraged to participate in, the very transactional nature of our society that says there is a different kind of contract available to us if we're prepared to walk in the way of Jesus. David Gowler reminds us that that kind of kingdom contract includes things like loving your enemies, doing good to those who hate you, blessing those who curse you, and praying for those who abuse you. They include turning the other cheek, giving to anyone who begs from you, and being merciful just as God is merciful. They include not only calling Jesus Lord, Lord, because really that's easy, but also doing what he taught. And if that sounds familiar, it's because that's what happens right before this text with either the Sermon on the Plain or the Sermon on the Mount. And here Luke is saying, I hope you get it. I hope you understand what this means. As an individual, and all these years later, I hope we understand what it means as a challenge to the church. Because we're surrounded by that transactional social contract. We're literally neck deep in it. It influences every aspect of our daily lives, and yet you and I are called to have faith. And not just faith that says, Lord, Lord, but faith that actually embodies what it means to be a disciple of the risen Christ, to be different in the world, to show communities what this community can do when it embraces the idea of come, grow, and serve. Because this contract, this way of being in the world, it doesn't just improve our bottom lines. It can actually heal the soul. It can heal what ails society. It can transform you and me. Because it isn't about embodying a sense of entitlement. And there are days when I believe we're all too familiar with that sense of entitlement. But the centurion doesn't profess to be entitled. The centurion professes faith. And it isn't grounded in a sense of power over or legislative authority. It is a deep faith that living the way of Jesus fundamentally affects who we are. And so we head into the summer. And there are lots of opportunities to be amazed, but there are even more opportunities to embody a life of faith. May we have the same courage as the centurion. And if the Christ showed up and looked at what we were doing as Parkdale United, my prayer is that Jesus would be amazed. May it be so. May Gwetch. Amen.